saying that we did kinetics by titration. We built our own dilatometers to do reaction kinetics, which works fine, except you have to have very good thermostats to do that. As I pointed out before, I did the calculations on a hand-cranked Monroe. And after World War II, I had Bruce Beckman DU, which is a great instrument. And very serviceable and marvelous for things like chromic acid work. We,
at some point or other, you also managed to buy a mass spectrometer?
Oh.
Around the Koshman work, and that was...
No, I'll tell you what happened then, and that was after World War II, too, and splendid. At the end of World War II, Robert Maynard Hutchins made another famous pronouncement about science, which was, if the university cannot avoid having science, it must at least have the best. And at that time, he brought to the university a really stellar collection of scientists, including Enrico Fermi, Joan Maria Mayer, Bill Libby, Edward Teller, who was never there, but oscillated about Chicago as his midpoint.
I see.
He was officially on the staff, but he was like a pendulum which spends the minimum time at the bottom of the swing.
I see.
He was minimally at Chicago. But among the people there at the university brought was Harold Urey. Harold Urey, I don't know where he got the funds, but had funds, and built his own mass spectrometers, and had excellent technicians, postdoctoral fellows, and mass spectrometers. He had isotope ratio mass spectrometers of the near type that he built, or his crew built, because he was engaged in this project to measure the temperatures of the ancient oceans by looking at the difference in the isotope ratios of carbon and oxygen in CO2 laid down at different temperatures. Now, the isotopic fractionation factor isn't very great, and its temperature coefficient is even smaller. So he had to have extremely good instrumentation to do this. So he had marvelous mass spectrometers, and he would run experiments for us from time to time. So he not only ran Koshland's, but also he ran, they did the original work on Myron Bender's first work when he was postdoctoral fellow in my lab. And before Myron came to the lab, I had arranged with Urey that he would, in fact, take care of that mass spectrometer. So those instruments were available post-war from Harold Urey. Incidentally, let me say for the University of Chicago, especially post-war, that if one was looking for an atmosphere in which one raised one's sights, in which one tried to look for broadly important problems, that the University of Chicago was the best atmosphere, perhaps in the world, to find. Well, without in any way wishing to depreciate the really great chemistry done in this department, there is a breadth of vision that was at Chicago that wasn't anywhere else. Here you had Harold Urey working on the temperatures of the ancient oceans, and after that on the origin of the planets, and Bill Libby doing his work on radiocarbon dating, although it was across the way and I never understood any of it, Maria Mayer working on the structure of the nucleus, and Conrad Bloch doing the original work that led to the path of carbon in the biosynthesis of steroids, and Morris Karosh laying down the fundamentals of free radical chemistry, mm-hmm. of unstable free radicals. It's a broader canvas. Mm-hmm. This isn't to say that the, in my view, Bob Woodward completely remade the way in which organic synthesis is done, and it's a great accomplishment. But it's a narrower kind of accomplishment than this great breadth of things that was going on in Chicago. Mm-hmm. That seems to me one couldn't help but find very exciting and very stimulating, mm-hmm. and conducive to an attempt to get at problems of both of considerable breadth and perhaps a little bit unusual isn't the word I'm looking for, but a little off the beaten track. Mm-hmm. It's a marvelous answer.
That's nice to hear of my old alma mater. My first response, however, and we'll get to that later, I guess, but yet you left. That may be a different story.
That's a different story.
So
I left because I'm a coward. And too many of our friends had been held up on the street at gunpoint. Too many people, women I knew, had been raped. Too many children I knew had been beaten up on the street. Mm-hmm.
I must say that was a story I heard way back when, and recently when I talked to Hammett, mm-hmm. he told me that he was trying to bring me to Columbia,
mm-hmm.
and I said, gee, you know, he was trying to get away from that in Chicago. He certainly wouldn't want to move into that atmosphere in New York, and he said that, well, it couldn't have been any better in Cambridge, of course. At that time, it certainly was.
It isn't so marvelous now.
Right.
There's been an enormous increase in crime over the country.
Yeah.
And anyway, I now don't have two small children.
Yeah. Yeah. And you lived in the community?
I lived in the university community. I guess we could have moved out of the university community to someplace safer and commuted.
Yeah.
I love the University of Chicago, and my reason for moving was simply that area became such a high crime area that I was frightened.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that didn't mean that I was so frightened that I was willing to run anywhere.
Yes.
But Harvard isn't so bad.
No.
But let me say that no matter how good Harvard was, I would not have left but for that pressure. Mm-hmm. And if you want to know why I left, that's it. Not because I didn't love the place. I did.
It's nice to hear it from a horse's mouth, but it's no longer an absolute rumor.
But, you know...
Do you have any idea what you told me about the physical organic course you were teaching? What else were you teaching at that time?
Or at Chicago.
Yeah.
Chicago, I taught a great many things. In particular, I took over the teaching of the elementary organic instruments and taught that with enormous enthusiasm and pleasure.
Have any recollection of what textbook you were using at that time?
Yes, at least for some of it, I was using one of Fieser's books. Was an enthusiast for Fieser's books. Many of the students were not. The reason I liked Fieser's books and preferred them to the other textbooks that were available is that what they had in them was the truth. That is, Fieser gave real examples. Many of the other textbooks had R groups and recited reactions in general, including some that didn't work. Fieser might have given things that were contrary to the rules, and that had some gimmicks in them, and were special cases. But everything in Fieser's books referred to things that were real, that were true. It seemed to me that that was a fabulous advantage. Later, he had a textbook that had one-line biographies of chemists at the bottom of the pages. And I thought that was extremely important, especially because many of the one-line biographies referred to recent graduates, often recent Harvard graduates, but still recent graduates. And I had never been very successful in telling students that they, too, were expected to invent new things and discover new things. When I'd say things like that, they would always laugh. And I would try to say, it may have been a nervous laughter, I don't know, but they would always laugh. And I would try to say, we don't understand the following thing, but of course, it's your generation who's going to find out what that is. They'd laugh. And it seemed to me that having at the bottom of the textbook page the name of someone whose name was mentioned in an elementary textbook and who graduated only 10 years earlier, 5 years earlier, had to be a way of saying that that the students would believe when they wouldn't believe me. So for those two reasons I liked Fieser's text. Now, of course, from the point of view of theoretical organic chemistry, they were abysmal. But it didn't seem to me that that made any difference, because I could survive that.
Well, they had those nice loops around the groups.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Exactly. But I was giving the theoretical part, and Fieser was giving them the straight facts and these little biographies. So I thought it was a good book, and I liked it, but students didn't like it much. But I enjoyed doing that. I even taught a course at Chicago. I once, when someone got sick or something, got caught teaching elementary physical chemistry. I gave a term of that.
Well, you've spent enough time talking and working with physical chemists, so you're...
It was not too dreadful. I wouldn't like to do it today when you're supposed to teach straight quantum mechanics, and I'm not a very good quantum mechanic.
If you dust off your Lewis and Ramel at that time, I suspect.
Yes, it was something like that. and so I could manage.
Who was Herzl Cohen?
Herzl Cohen changed his name to Herzl Conway.
Is he on the list then? Because I didn't find him listed as one of your graduate students or postdocs.
And do you have the list with you? Let's see if Herzl Conway is on the list.
Okay. Okay, that was the result of some of the anti-Semitism in the world at the time.
Right.
How did you divide the research, the teaching? How much time did you have to spend at each? Was there ever a conflict between the teaching and the research? Or did you find them? One was necessary for the other. I don't know.
I never felt pressed for time then.
Mm-hmm.
I feel pressed for time now. It seems to me that I wasn't pressed for time then for a number of reasons, some of them very bad, which I will assign. But anyway, I never felt a conflict between teaching and research. It seemed to me that it was great fun doing both. There was plenty of time to do both. And I never felt that I was taking time from one for the other. Either way. Now, the reasons are probably all the following, and maybe some others. First, if you don't know all the things that you should be doing, it doesn't hurt you so much when you don't do them. I have never read as much in the literature as many of my friends do. I have always, I guess, been behind in the reading of current journals. What I tend to do is rely considerably on the educational value of lunch, where my friends will tell me what it is I should have read, chiding me for not having read it. But that, you know, then it points out what I should read, and I go read it. It also has led me, I think, to read very much more broadly, in a much greater variety of themes. But to do that, you don't read everything. So that where, as Frank Mayo tried to get me in the habit of going through chem abstracts and really reading everything to do with chemistry, I found I couldn't do it. I would be reading and reading and reading, and then I would stop and say, I have no idea what I've read. It had all vanished. There wasn't any point in it. And by and large, I would find that I did better doing something like spending 2 months learning how to handle electrostatic equations and not reading the journals very heavily. So, yes, I cheated, if you can call it that, on reading the journals,
mm-hmm.
and read various things people called my attention to or that I wanted especially to read, and was more likely to read intensively on a little thing than to read the journals in general. There weren't very many graduate students at the University of Chicago. Now, it's true that one can go in the lab and work in the lab, and it'll take a lot of time. But if you have a few graduate students and you worry intensively about their problems, it doesn't take as much time. as it does when you have a big research group. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure you get much less done. I'm not convinced that when I had a group of 15 people here, that I really had 15 research ideas.
Mm-hmm.
One of my dicta, which Dan Greenberg stole and published in Science without giving me any credit, though he had taken it directly, he even wrote me a letter apologizing, is that a great scientist makes a discovery in his life. A good scientist makes a discovery once a decade, and any damn fool can make a discovery every year. You don't really need a large group of people to do revolutionary science. Frederick Sanger had two graduate students who worked successively, not concurrently, on the structure of insulin. And he and two graduate students did that job and revolutionized a major part of chemistry. It didn't take a big crew of people. And I never believed that you had to have a big crew of people. I keep having discussions, and this is off this, but on the question of philosophy of science, really, with I have these discussions with Bob Woodward all the time.
He was the first one I thought of when you started talking about large groups working on projects.
Bob will not be, that doesn't like to accept my evaluations in chemistry. If we stick to synthetic organic chemistry, he is clearly the best there is in the world. If you say, well, yes, but if you're writing a history of science in the 20th century, where will that work stand, and where will Sanger's stand?
You say this to him? You say this to him?
Not in those words, but yes. I mean, this is where we get in this discussion of values. He doesn't want to look values. I mean, if you ask him about Sanger's work, he says, well, that's obvious. Anyone can see that. It's obvious. Well, it is, in fact. Sanger's work is absolutely obvious. Anyone who knew any organic chemistry, any of them, hundreds and hundreds of students who have taken my course in elementary organic chemistry at the University of Chicago, and certainly I, could easily have seen what Sanger saw. Only we didn't. And he did. We had a discussion like this with Bob Woodward about Corona, whose work I consider among the great pieces of work in synthetic organic chemistry, and the synthesis of a gene certainly must take precedence over any other organic synthesis I know. And it was prior to that time when Corona was making the trinucleotides and so on from which the genetic code was finally firmed up. He was working out all the methodology for making nucleotides. I was praising this work to Bob, and Bob said, well, he thought it was routine, and that he knew at least 30 organic chemists who could have done the same work more elegantly and much more quickly. And I said to Bob, my mother-in-law told me that she would have been Phi Beta Kappa if only she had gone to college. So I don't think the large groups are needed. And I had a small group, and it kept me busy. It was everything I could really handle. It involved more thinking about what you were going to do. And the teaching didn't get in the way at all. And in fact, certainly the chromic acid project arose directly from teaching elementary organic chemistry, getting up at the blackboard, reciting these facts about chromic acid oxidations, and having the inside of my mind turning over and saying, my God, what are you saying? How does this work? What's going on? So that in that sense, the teaching of elementary organic chemistry was a direct prod to the to research. And I will go a step further and say that it seems to me, to a considerable extent, the research projects that arise out of elementary teaching are going to be the best ones. Because it's the most fundamental problems that you teach in the elementary courses. Mm-hmm. And if there's something that you don't understand about the elementary course, one ought to do something. What?
That makes a lot of sense.
Now let's see.
Okay.
The
go on with some of the things you wrote.
All right. I think I ought to say a word or two about that project with Joe Mayer, which I think was nice project.
Absolutely.
That really, I think, is the beginning of molecular mechanics, which has blossomed a great deal recently.
I would like you to say something about him. I wanted to ask you about Joe Mayer too. He came along with Yuri from Columbia.
Yes. He was part of this group along with Maria Mayer, that came in after World War II. In this marvelous acquisitions of Hutchins.
You know, part of that acquisition was because Yuri was angry at Columbia. He had been chairman, and the rest of the staff just didn't want him to be chairman anymore, and enough people were unhappy, and so they wouldn't re-elect him chairman. I don't know if you knew anything about that or not.
No, I didn't know anything about that.
Harold
Urey is an eccentric, but a hero of mine.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm taking up so much time doing all this. I don't know if it's worthwhile, but let me tell you one of my stories about Harold Urey, which is just personal. I mean, it doesn't bear on science, really. It just tells you about Harold Urey. And it's part of, you know, my feeling about that. A few years ago, at La Jolla, he was taken to the hospital for some sort of a serious operation. I don't know. This is an abdominal operation of some sort, quite serious one. And he was put in a room, semi-private room, the day before, the way they always do to prepare people for operations. And his roommate was Nathan Kaplan. I don't know if you know Nate Kaplan. He's a biochemist. And he had a heart attack and had been in the hospital for weeks. So Harold Urey got in the hospital bed and took out his briefcase and pulled his glasses and took out a paper and started to write. And after a while, Nate Kaplan said, "Harold, put that stuff down." Nate said, "You know, I've been in this hospital 3 weeks. I'm bored to tears. I haven't had anybody to talk to. We're old friends. Put that stuff down and let's talk for a while." So Harold took off his glasses and he looked over at Nate. He said, "Nate, I'm well over 80 years old. I'm going into surgery tomorrow for an important abdominal operation. And it's There's a reasonable chance I won't survive. And I intend to finish this paper. Put his glasses back on and went to work.
Another marvelous story. That's very good. Yeah.
And, you know, well. When I do my history of science, it's going to be it's going to be a collection of stories.
Anecdotal stories
about scientists.
I think one of the problems with history of science and history of chemistry up to now is that most of the people have turned and gone through the journals and said, this happened now and this happened now, and nobody knew what was happening. You know, the fact that scientists are people and they interact with one another and they do have ideas and feelings and so on. And science is very often done by that.
Anyway, I came back to Chicago after World War II.
Okay.
And the university was very good to me, and it promoted me to associate professor on the basis of hopes as much as accomplishment.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done some fairly good things that weren't published, that got published later, that have been classified.
Yeah.